won by Mother Jones. It's been won by Amy Goodman, Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, Center for Media and Democracy, Bob Scheer, City Limits. So at Ithaca, we're trying to show some of the journalism students, not all, but the journalism students that are interested, that there's another way to go for your career.
That's awesome.
And that a lot of these new outlets are actually, you know, a lot of them are struggling financially, like community radio, but a lot of them are also hiring. And so that's what our program is about.
Excellent. Hey, Jeff, I just have to leave it there. Sometime okay. I got to have to bring you on for a whole great big show. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jeff Cohen. And
bye-bye.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in. Find out more about Steve Buell's work at Steve Buell, that's B-U-E-L, Portland School Board member on Facebook. Learn about Karanja Cruz, Teaching with Purpose Conference at teachingwithpurpose.com. Jeff Cohen, find the petition calling for CNN to include progressive journalists on the Democratic Party debate next week at rootsaction.org and then ithaca.org/indy. Thanks for tuning in.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Call Out for Justice and the Wars. Rally and march on Sunday, October 11th, starting at 1 p.m. at Shemansky Park in Portland. Over 35 peace, environmental, police accountability, and other social justice groups from the Portland area will be mobilizing around the 14th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, with the march and rally to stop the wars overseas on the people, on human rights, and on the planet. Again, it's a call out for justice and the wars. Sunday, October 11th at 1 p.m. beginning at Shemansky Park, the South Park blocks at Salmon Street in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kibu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Tuesday, Katrina van den Heuvel, editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation magazine, will be live on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's this Tuesday, live on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series sponsored by Northwest Film Center. October 2nd through November 5th are the dates. While cinema provides entertainment and escape for many committed filmmakers and viewers, it's a vital medium of engagement and a powerful tool for social action. Films in the series include 50 Feet from Syria, Dreamcatcher, No Land's Song, and We Come as Friends. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film from October 2nd to November 5th at the Northwest Film Center in the Whitzel Auditorium of the Portland Art Museum, located at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue here in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:03 a.m. This is usually when we'd hear Eric Cascadia, which is taking the day off, and we will instead hear Flashpoints for the Hour, followed at 11 by The Digital Divide with your host, Rabia Yemen. And now, from our siblings in struggle in the San Francisco Bay Area, from from Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley, here is Flashpoints.
Today on flashpoints. The Sonoma County Sheriff's Department of California sued for a series of violent in-custody beatings. We'll talk to the lead attorney in the case. Also, how U.S. policy gave rise to the Islamic State. And the Biggs Beat returns. The Biggs Beat returns to take another microscopic look at the history of Stonewall and the whitewashing of its history. And we'll have another edition of the Electric Intifada.net with Norbaris Friedman. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, family members of former Sonoma County jail inmates who claim they were subjected to 5.5 hours of uninterrupted beatings by correctional deputies expressed outrage at the alleged assault this past Tuesday as their lawyer urged Sheriff Steve Fertitas to release a purported videotape of the event. The comments followed Monday's filing of a federal civil rights lawsuit in U.S. District Court in San Francisco, alleging guards systematically and sadistically beat 20 inmates locked in a high-security unit. Joining us to talk about the case and to give us some background is Itzhak Schweiger. He is the attorney. He's based in the Santa Rosa area. Mr. Schweiger, it's good to have you back on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me, Dennis.
Well, first of all, would you set the scene? Exactly what happened and how did you learn of this? How did you document this?
So this particular event happened back in May, at the end of May of this year. We started receiving some reports out of the jail through other attorneys who represented some of these young men in their criminal matters. And the first reports that came through were, you know, a little bit difficult to believe, but we interviewed more than 15 individual inmates at the jail and received correspondence with over 20 of them, all with nearly identical accounts of what took place. Apparently, this all began when there was a verbal altercation between an inmate and a correctional deputy, and that confrontation occurred through the door of his locked individual cell. And that's an important component here because each of these individuals was in a single cell, a 6x10 concrete block room with a metal door. The argument escalated. The inmate called the guard some names. The guard went back for backup, and along with a number of other deputies, entered this particular inmate's cell and began a fairly violent and horrific beating. Some of the other inmates were able to witness this happening out of their window ports and their cells, the ones that were across the module, and they began protesting and calling out for the deputies to stop the beating. In return for their protests, they were each systematically pulled out of their cells one at a time over the course of the next 5 hours or so and subjected to similar beatings at the hands of jail staff.
All right. Say a little bit more about the process, what happened there. So jail staff participated. Was it sort of like a gangbang? A couple of guards would beat the hell out of somebody, then take them back to their cell. Could the other prisoners hear the beatings going on and anticipate what was coming? Give us a little bit more of the information on that.
So we believe that there were more than a dozen sheriff's deputies that were involved in the beatings. We know the identities of a few of them and are waiting for the disclosure of the IDs of the rest of them. One of the reasons that we don't know everyone involved is because when the guards entered the cells, they had suited up into basically riot gear, black body armor, and riot helmets, but they were also wearing black ski masks. None of them wore badges or name tags. So the inmates just had these black figures and black masks enter their cells. Prior to the entrance of the guards, they would have the inmates cuff up, which means back up to the door, place their hands next to the food tray slot so they could be cuffed. And then the guards would enter, dressed in black, throw the handcuffed inmate down on the ground and begin beating him. Then they'd take the inmate out of his cell, out into the, quote, yard, and begin a session of what is commonly known in the jail as yard counseling. Yard counseling involves the deliberate application of violence to inmates to try to change a behavior problem. It's not in any of the policy books that we've seen, but it's such a well-recognized term at the jail that everybody knows what you're talking about when you mention it.
Wow. And you say 10 guards, was it men and women, all men?
No, we actually think that there was at least one female deputy that was involved, but I believe that there was actually more than a dozen. We don't know the exact numbers right now. Some of the inmates could see what was going on. All of them could hear it as it was happening around them. One of the first things that one of the sergeants on duty did once the beatings began was to go door to door down the tier and shut the window portals on each door so that the inmates couldn't watch what was happening nearby. But the inmates could still see out their food tray slots or under the crack in the door, and they could hear as the violence went on all around them. One of our plaintiffs, Danny Banks, was the last one to be beaten. He said that he listened for 4.5 hours as people were just crying and screaming and begging the guards to stop the abuse. He knew it was coming for him, so he laid down face first on his mattress, put his hands behind his back, crossed his legs, and thought perhaps that by showing submission, he'd be spared, but they just saved him for last, and they entered his cell and did the same thing to him as they did to everyone else.
All right, and please, how bad were the wounds?
So the injuries were, you know, they ran the spectrum. We think there may have been one individual who suffered some broken bones, but we know very well that one of the individuals who is going to be joined to the suit in the next few weeks was beaten so badly that he defecated himself, lost control of his bowels, and then, of course, when the guards saw that that had happened, they laughed at him, they stripped him naked, and they put him in an isolation cell covered in his own feces for 2 days and didn't permit him to shower for another 6 days. So he had blood in his stool for several weeks, serious pain in his abdomen and about his head for as much as a month after the beatings occurred.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are talking with attorney Isaac Schweiger. He is representing a whole bunch of folks who claim to be having been beaten in, a little bit of a sheriff's riot while in custody. And where were they in custody, and which facility?
So this is at the main adult detention facility in Santa Rosa, and they were in the administrative segregation ward of that jail, which is a very important fact given the sheriff's response to the allegations has been that the deputies were merely responding to a coordinated riot of some kind in the jail. But in the administrative segregation unit, every inmate is confined to a single cell, a single room. None of them can, barely have any communication with anything outside of their own room, let alone a coordinated riot. Having discussed the facts of the case with certain corrections people and prison experts, it's generally considered appropriate that if someone's acting up in administrative segregation, that they just let them yell it out, so to speak. So this whole idea that this was some kind of a riot is laughable.
And in terms of who knew what, when did
this... Well,
we
know that the sheriff was aware of what happened. It was the entire facility ended up being on lockdown for over 24 hours following the beatings. So certainly not just jail staff, but because the jail falls under the supervision of the sheriff was absolutely aware that this had happened.
This is a one horrific incident that you're describing. That, what did you say about, you think maybe 30 former prisoners suffered?
Over 20.
Over 20.
And it's a one very long, horrible incident, which is unique, I think.
Okay, you say unique. In other words, there is no indication that there is a pattern or practice of brutality
in
this
jail? Oh, no, quite to the contrary. We believe that there is a pattern and practice of brutality. The only thing unique about this case is that it was such a well-orchestrated, deliberate, systematic beatdown of so many people. That's what makes it unique. Since the lawsuit was filed, the phone's been ringing off the hook in the office. In fact, we just had another line put in today, because there have been so many similar complaints. People saying, you know, calling up and saying, this happened to me, this happened to my father, this happened to my brother, but no one would believe us. And so the response from the community has been alarming, to say the least.
All right. Tell us a little bit about some of the family members that you're working with and how this lawsuit came about, because it's, you know, people that you're representing certainly don't have a great deal in the way of means to afford this kind of protection. And so often this kind of brutality is simply passed over, and we never hear the stories of those who do the suffering. So tell us about the process here, because it's pretty unique in itself.
Well, you know, we have people, most of whom were truly indigent, housed in this area. But, you know, a lot of them were being represented by court-appointed counsel or public defenders or whatnot. But that didn't stop the word from getting out because, you know, despite their indigency and despite the accusations against them, you know, a lot of them were pretrial detainees. Some of them were convicted prisoners. You know, the professionals in the legal community up here and the defense bar are pretty remarkable folks. And they brought these allegations to my attention. And again, it was, you know, it was hard to believe at first, but after so many, it just became something that we could not ignore. And you can't not do something when so many people come to you and they say, please help, no one will believe us. There's no one else that can help us. So my office kind of took up the charge on this one. And because we already have pending litigation against the jail for other acts of abuse and misconduct, we were able to kind of dovetail some of that litigation into this, and through our litigation and other cases, uncover more information, which led us to realize that the allegations were true, not only that the beatings had taken place, but actually they had been videoed by jail staff.
Now, is there any indication that there was racism at play?
It's hard to say. One of the things that's unique about this case is that in administrative segregation, you know, a lot of times that's where they put people suspected of being gang members.